why did we Western industrialized democracies do so poorly? I mean, why did we get into huge fights over things like masks and tracing apps in the middle of the worst pandemic of a century? You know, we spent an inordinate amount of time fighting about when we possibly had better things to think about.
Hello, welcome to Cambridge Forum, coming to you live via Zoom. I'm Mary Stack, the Executive Director, and today we're considering how well the world handled the first wave of the pandemic. Today, as the highly transmissible Delta variant spreads across the country in a third wave, we see more clearly than ever how the COVID-19 pandemic has emerged as the biggest global public health challenge in history. Just when we thought we had some things under control and governments were tentatively opening up, we now find ourselves in a pandemic of the unvaccinated, according to the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky. But before we get to all that, let me start by introducing today's erudite guests. Peter Waldwin is a professor of comparative history at UCLA. His latest book is Fighting the First Wave, How the Coronavirus Was Tackled Differently Around the Globe. Our second guest is Professor Bill Hannage, an epidemiologist at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health, where he's a faculty member at the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics. Welcome to you both. Let's start with you, Peter. It is worth remembering the statistics attached to two of the well-known plagues in history. I think the Black Death caused 200 million deaths in 4 years, and the 1918 influenza epidemic in 1918 infected 500 million and killed 50 million worldwide. Meanwhile, COVID has infected a reported 192 million with 4.2 million deaths to date. In context then, how has this SARS-CoV-19 pandemic different from other historical pandemics that you've studied? Is it as bad as we think it is?
It's the worst thing that's happened to us in these terms since 1918, by which I mean an epidemic that sort of hits us quickly and, you know, evidently. I mean, in terms of overall deaths, HIV has killed many more people so far over the last 20, 30 years. So if you're looking at it from that point of view, we're not anywhere near that yet. So in that sense, what you say is right. But this is something that we have been scared into thinking about, and rightly so.
Let's go back to 18 months ago now. So it's January 2020. This new coronavirus has unleashed itself on the world. There's pandemonium everywhere. 200 countries are facing the same challenge, but they responded in quite different, startlingly different ways. So you argue in your book that the pandemic was a problem in geoepidemiology. Each country was battling the virus with wildly varied resources. And you talked about those. You said there was the individual country's experience with disease. There was the quality of its healthcare, the equality of its society. And lastly, the historic relationship between the governors and the governed. Can you explain a little bit of what you meant by this?
Well, keep firmly in mind that during the first year, we are dealing strictly with a public health issue. There's no medical solution, there's no vaccination, there's no cure, nothing like that. Everything changes in December, January of this year, January of this year. When we get the vaccines, it's a totally different ballgame. But in the first year or so of the pandemic, all we had to work with were public health measures of the sort that effectively we've been using since biblical times: quarantine, isolation, shutting down travel, keeping people from each other, that sort of thing. Now, I suppose it's fair to say that the disease was, of course, the same everywhere in the world, but the epidemic wasn't in the beginning. In the beginning, you know, it hit different places quite differently. Some places were islands and managed to actually shut themselves down and sort of stay out of the fray for a while. New Zealand, Australia, Iceland, places like that. In the beginning, you know, there was even talk about sort of biological differences. The Buddhist Triangle in Southeast Asia was surprisingly unhit, and people wondered why that was. It's not that long ago that Indian journalists wrote in The New Yorker and places like that that one of the reasons for why India had such a low rate was that Indians had robust immune systems compared to Westerners, because, you know, they were used to putting up with the insults of an unsanitary everyday environments. You know, we hear a lot less about that these days. The playing field has sort of been leveled in that sense. So for the first many months, it was sort of a different pandemic in different places, and that helps explain part of the difference in the response. You know, the reason why they weren't taking it very seriously in Dakotas compared to the coasts in this country had a lot to do with the fact that, you know, there were more cases and people were more worried about it. And the places where it took longer to get, they were insouciant for longer. So different pandemic for a while, but in a sense, the variants have now leveled that playing field. And, you know, we see that the variants are sort of going in where it was untouched or at least not terribly ravaged the ground before. So the pandemic experience from a public health point of view has been different for the first year of the pandemic. If you want to think about the public health response and why that has differed, that's of course a whole other set of questions. And in the book, I try to outline the broad scope of the differences in response. The Asian countries did comparatively well. I include here New Zealand and Australia as honorary Asian countries, but geographically, they're obviously that. And certainly the way that they behaved vis-a-vis the pandemic, they were Asian in that sense too. These countries sort of recognized it quite quickly, clamped down, locked down, shut down intercourse insofar as it needed to be. And if they didn't do that, they controlled and tested their population so that they could isolate those who were ill and therefore prevent any further spread. And they did sort of quite well throughout the first year of the pandemic. Then, of course, there's the rest of us, as it were, those nations who didn't pay attention early enough, who didn't shut down travel early enough, for whom suddenly it was a matter of waking up and discovering that the pandemic was not only present, but had spread much further than we thought already, and for whom there wasn't really much else to do but a kind of post hoc lockdown in hopes of squashing it after the fact. And then finally, there were a couple countries that decided to sort of be much more insouciant about it. Some of them hitched their fortunes to the wagon of herd immunity, thinking that there was actually an advantage in letting the disease wash through the population. No politician really admitted that, but some of them seemed to have acted on that assumption. And, you know, among the oddest of these countries is perhaps Sweden, where they decided there was really no reason to tell the Swedes what to do because they knew perfectly well what to do on their own, and they would do the right thing. And yet at the same time, they also welcomed herd immunity. So clearly the Swedes were out about doing things they shouldn't have been doing, because otherwise you wouldn't have gotten herd immunity. So, you know, there were a variety of approaches that were taken, some of them sort of forced upon nations and some of them voluntarily chosen. The Swedes didn't have to do what they did. The Belgians probably didn't have much of a choice once they discovered they had been infected.
You mentioned this competence and compliance being very connected in terms of who did what when and how things worked or didn't work. And you mentioned some of them. So what about leadership? I mean, Trump and Bolsonaro were both kind of fairly chaotic populist leaders in this regard, or non-leaders, actually. So that led to a lot of confusion, particularly in a country like the States, where we've got so many autonomous states doing their own thing. So partly, I think there was a big disconnect between like the CDC and the federal government and individual state health authorities. So in some ways, I wonder how accurate, and this brings me to China, where everything started, how accurate do you think the actual statistics are about deaths, etc.? I looked up the other day and it had some silly amount, like 5,000 people had died in China. Can't possibly be true. I mean, so are we getting an accurate view of what's going on when we're kind of reliant on people volunteering some of this information?
I have no particular opinion about the quality of the Chinese statistics. I'm sure that your broad point is right, that we not all statistics are equally good. I went in and had a look at the Indian statistics today. If you believe the Indian figures, they still have a mortality rate that is about the same level as the mortality rate per capita as Denmark. That's seems perhaps a bit unlikely. Who knows? But I think sort of broadly speaking, it is certainly the case the Chinese were not hit anywhere nearly as hard as others by virtue of clamping down. And even if they did more poorly than they would like to present themselves as having done, I think we have a pretty transparent view of what went on in South Korea and Taiwan and other places in that part of the world that also did extremely well. So
that part of the world was already prepared, more prepared than anybody else, it seemed.
Yes, these nations knew what they knew more of what they were dealing with and were better prepared to sort of clamp down. They had a lot of the infrastructure ready to go in a population that sort of understood that it really isn't all that bad a thing if your government is, tracking your movements, using your bank accounts and your credit card statements and all that sort of thing, and are not going to kick up a fuss about it. Mm-hmm. You know, the extraordinary thing in the democracies is, why did we Western industrialized democracies do so poorly? And part of that has to have to do with the fact that we played up the civil liberties aspect. I mean, why did we get into huge fights over things like masks and tracing apps in the middle of the worst pandemic of a century? I have yet to hear a reasonable explanation of what civil right precisely it is that masks violate, or the obligation to wear them violate. I mean, it's a clue to me what it is that's being taken from people. And the idea that privacy and the ability of the authorities to find out where you've been and whether you've been in proximity to somebody who's been infected, that somehow violates a right that is more important in the midst of a pandemic than the ability to track and trace is also obscure to me. But these are the kinds of battles that, you know, we spent an inordinate amount of time fighting about when we possibly had better things to think about.
This is probably a little bit hard to gauge, but having a change of administration where we feel, you know, most of us, that somebody's actually running the show now and it's in control and has actually immediately put measures into place to try and deal with this on a very large scale. Is it hard because that trust thing that you're talking about, that contract between compliance and competence, was already kind of marred for many people by the first 12 months or so of having someone not running any kind of program in terms of vaccination or protection? I mean, it was just very much, we were very late to the game. So how much does that damage public trust, really?
Hugely, I would be my guess. On the other hand, I think in some ways, you know, public leaders in the democracies wildly underestimated the extent to which their populations actually wanted them to be decisive and to make them feel secure. You know, we see that in quite clearly in the UK, where the Boris Johnson's government, you know, waving his Tory libertarian flag, said, oh, no, you know, the average Brit doesn't want to be locked down, doesn't want to be deprived of the liberty to go to the pub and all that sort of thing. And yet, you know, public opinion polls revealed that the average Brit was perfectly happy to sit home and as long as they could feel secure. And, you know, even today, Freedom Day, Liberty Day, whatever they call it, the Guardian or the FT, I've forgotten which one it was, you know, described central London this morning as, you know, looking more like Seville in August, you know, because everyone, with again a few exceptions, sort of the 20-year-olds going out clubbing, nobody's sort of rushing off to restaurants and to sit inside because they know perfectly well that it's not a sensible thing to do. So I think that this idea that some people were, you know, chomping at the bit of their liberties is wildly exaggerated.
But just one thing that you said in the book that I thought was quite interesting. You said many humanities student had cause to reflect on the complexity and fragility of modern society's supply chains. Others became aware not only of the existence, but also the eminent dignity of the invisible people who made their lives possible. So being idealistic here for a moment, do you think we learned any lessons, any good lessons on that, or are they very temporary lessons?
Well, you're quoting me quoting someone, and the someone I'm quoting is Bernard-Henri Lévy, you know, as the classic champagne socialist. I thought it was slightly ironic that suddenly he would discover the trials and tribulations of the common man during his lockdown. But I think he was actually, you know, unwittingly speaking for many of us who might not be as frank and willing to admit it as was he, which is that not all of us realized what it takes to keep our lives functioning until suddenly we can't go outside and we realize what exactly is involved in putting food on the shelves in the grocery stores and delivering the mail and getting the Amazon packages there and keeping, you know, your pool filters cleaned and whatever else goes into your average middle and upper middle class life. So one of the great divides, not that it comes as a huge revelation to us. We knew it all along, but we don't talk about it. One of the great divides within the industrialized world was, of course, between those who had to go out and work to keep those of us who stayed at home happy in our self-imposed exiles. So that is one of the great social divides that we became painfully aware of. Clapping for the NHS doctors, you know, we should equally have been clapping for the trash men. We should have been basically spending our days clapping for everyone. And then, of course, the other divide that now is becoming increasingly evident is that between the vaccinated first world and the still unvaccinated global south, which is, you know, being ravaged in a way that is not yet the case in the first world by yet another wave, and a wave that is worse because it's the variants with their higher transmissibility and whatever else may be involved there.
Well, I do think one little note of hope is that I see that a lot of service workers haven't rushed back to their jobs. In fact, they're having a lot of trouble in Massachusetts getting waiters and bartenders and what have you back to work. So I think it's actually pushed their wages up, which I think is great.
Well, the public health response in this country and in the UK is largely the same, was pretty catastrophic. There's no question about that. And a lot of that is owed to our presidential leadership or its lack. On the other hand, having said that, there are two things that the Trump administration did get right. And one of them was just pour a ton of money into keeping the economy afloat. I mean, who knew that America had a welfare state of that sort? But improvisedly, we did. And the other was pour a ton of money into getting vaccines as quickly as you possibly can. And there he was right too. You know, the UK and the US made a hash of the public health response. They were brilliant when it came to the vaccine response. Lots of other countries, it's in effect the reverse. I mean, if you look at Australia and New Zealand right now, that did brilliantly during the public health response and then sat on their hands.
Yeah. So and Canada did too.
Waiting for what? I mean, why were they not sort of importing vaccines up the wazoo and getting the population vaccinated? And now they're sort of sitting there saying, what, me? And, you know, why should we get vaccinated? Things are fine here. And so, you know, they're now virgin territory for sort of new variants to sort of come and eat them. And it's a weird reversal of fortune that having played their hand so well the first time, they then end up misplaying it in the long run.
Well, it couldn't possibly sustain just doing the isolation thing. It was very short-term thinking, really, wasn't it?
Well, but it was the only thing that could be done at the moment. I mean, it was a holding pattern. I think we all understand that the public health response wasn't a permanent solution unless we had somehow locked down the entire globe everywhere. If everybody had just stayed home for 3 weeks and somehow managed to, you know, not die of starvation, you know, we would have been in the same position as we were the day before patient zero. But that's obviously logistically not going to work. Given that, obviously the public health response is only a holding pattern until, ideally, some kind of medical vaccine solution arrives and allows us out of it. And that's where Australia and New Zealand ended up flubbing it, not sort of being prepared for that next step.
So when your book came out in April, Peter, is there any way that you could have envisaged that we'd now be on the third wave of this thing? I mean, most doctors probably didn't anticipate it.
I think everybody anticipated it because without a vaccine, there was going to be sort of series of further waves. Who knows how many? So I don't think there's any sort of big mystery about you know, there being another wave. What's happened since the book came out? There are two big things. One is the vaccines, and the other is the variants, and they sort of go hand in hand. The vaccines change the game radically. They give us the possibility of getting out of it. On the other hand, the variants, as more people get it and are not vaccinated yet, the variants, of course, multiply. And you know, depending on what the variants do, it's sort of a race now between the vaccines and the variants. So the public health response was just, you know, the first step. Now comes the serious step of actually sort of exiting from the pandemic. And, you know, whether and how we do that is, that's an ongoing story. The hope, of course, is that this third wave is going to be less dangerous than the first two waves because of the effect of the vaccine. But, you know, that's a question of whether we get the vaccination done before further variants come.
You're listening to Cambridge Forum as we consider what the world has learned from the first wave of COVID. Well, now's the perfect time to switch to Bill Hannage, who's an epidemiologist at Harvard's Chan Public Health School, He's also a faculty member at the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics. You just arrived or returned from the UK this week. And yesterday, Boris Johnson removed many of the social restraints that have been there for months and months. Was this a bit premature in your opinion? And how did you behave when you were there?
Those are both good questions. I think the thing you've got to remember when you think about the UK is that it's not exactly been under the most stringent of restrictions for quite some time. And there's been exponential growth of Delta happening since April. So the final, you know, when you're talking about the final sort of Freedom Day, to give it the title which it was bestowed upon it by the right-wing press, to focus on that to the exclusion of what happened before is a mistake in my view. What does happen about Freedom Day is that it allows large groupings of people to get together. We were talking about nightclubs just now. And that's going to be particularly anxiety inducing because it looks like Delta has a very strong capacity for super spreading. And so over the last few months, you have been able to see the exponential growth being driven by younger age groups, the 20-somethings, and indeed adolescents. Schools were open, high schools were open. Mask mandates were withdrawn on the 17th of May. This all went together into producing a situation where there are daily case counts in the UK at the moment rivaling the highest that they have ever been. Now, this is not producing a huge catastrophe in the National Health Service, but it is producing strain already. And we can expect there to be more strain because cases have been increasing very rapidly the last few weeks, and it's too early for those to really be rocking into healthcare. So it is premature. It would have been much better, in my view, to have waited a bit longer so you could have vaccinated those younger age groups. I also think it would be better to have apportioned some vaccine doses to those younger age groups earlier in order to get the indirect benefit of limiting transmission. However, it is a situation as it is, and hopefully we're going to be able to look at it and learn something from it.
So when you were there, how comfortable did you feel knowing what you know, moving around? Did you feel that you wanted to wear a mask?
Oh, yes. I did not wear a mask outside. I still think that, and I met a friend and we sat in the middle of Blackheath with a couple of tinnies and the stiff breeze blowing between us. But you know, when I went indoors into public spaces, yes, I wore a mask at all times, not least because of the fact that I knew I was due to be traveling back to the United States and I didn't want my travel plans to be disrupted because I am double vaccinated. I've got two mRNA shots. And so I am protected from the worst consequences of infection, even with Delta. On the other hand, I'm not keen to contribute to Delta spread, and the daily incidence in the UK is really very high at the moment. So I think that we need to think carefully about how we handle these things. It's very interesting, Mary, to contrast the United Kingdom with Israel, which is another country with high rates of immunization, but which put an indoor mask mandate in place very rapidly as Delta started to take off, and then concentrated on vaccinating younger age groups. At the moment, the situation there is more under control than it is in the UK. And in general, Israel has had a far better pandemic. In fact, if the per capita mortality in Israel were applied to the United Kingdom up to now, there'd be about 80,000 people there still alive. So you can actually, over this point, you can see the consequences of making those bad decisions.
Going back now to how this particular virus is, or pandemic attached to this virus, is different from others that we've known historically. I think it's quite interesting. You know what makes it a fairly unique kind of pandemic. And one of the things you were saying, which I didn't realize and I didn't really think about, was something like Ebola can be transmitted, but you know you have it. It's clear that you have it. Yeah. And the big thing about this, particularly this Delta variant, because it is young people walking around carrying it, and some of them are vaccinated. My daughter has it and she was fully vaccinated. So there are breakthrough infections. But how is this different? Is it largely the fantastically fast speed, the speed of the transmissibility is now so much faster than the original COVID, in conjunction with the fact that you don't know you have it?
Well, people right from the start of it didn't know they necessarily had it. Mm-hmm. That's the most crucial thing in whether or not an infectious disease is controllable. If people can be transmitting it unwittingly, then it becomes very hard to deal with. The big difference between SARS-CoV-2 and SARS-CoV-1 was that SARS-CoV-1 transmitted from people once they developed symptoms. So it was comparatively easy to, you know, put on a mask to stay away from people who are coughing and spluttering. It becomes much harder when any substantial fraction of transmission happens from people who are either pre-symptomatic or with very mild symptoms, you know, who transmit it without knowing. And a significant fraction of people infected with SARS-CoV-2, even Delta, don't have particularly severe symptoms, but they can transmit it. I mean, this is one thing that we have to recall. SARS-CoV-2 and COVID, the disease that results from it, are in a position where it's very hard to control. And I think Peter probably knows more than I do about the way that governments have responded to this. But it's hard to persuade people to take strong action to prevent infections with something which can appear mild, but which, when thousands of people and millions of people all become infected with it at the same time, will pose very severe damage to healthcare systems and have very, very significant mortality. Now, nobody should be under any illusions about what this virus can do now. And yet, the majority of people who get infected with it will be fine. And those two things can both be true. And it's quite hard to communicate that.
You said in an interview on The World, the emergence of Delta is catastrophic. In the knowledge that 97% of those who are currently hospitalized are unvaccinated, how worried should the rest of us be? And should we be rethinking our behavior in light of this?
I think it's very important to note that vaccines, the mRNA vaccines in particular, but even the maligned Oxford-AstraZeneca one, do provide very good protection indeed against hospitalization and death. They don't stop all breakthrough disease, as you know. Mm. However, they do have a really, really good public health impact. When I said it was catastrophic, I was thinking as much of the fact that once you have something which can be highly transmissible, which transmits really quickly, which is another thing about Delta, you have this problem that you've got, this is an epidemiologist's nightmare, because it's a highly transmissible virus which will get into people before we can vaccinate them. And that means that we're going to have a far more worrying next few months than we would have had if we were dealing with the old alpha variant, or even more so the founder virus before then. So when I say it's catastrophic, I'm not so much thinking about the United States, although there are a few counties down there in the South that really could stand to up their vaccination rates. It was more about the rest of the world. Those of us who are vaccinated, if you don't want to contribute to Delta spread, consider wearing a mask indoors, try and avoid going to crowded areas, in particular where you don't know the vaccine status of people, and keep an eye on what's happening locally.
So going forward now, is this just something that, I don't know, you said this time next year, maybe I've got this wrong, but I think you said this time next year, everyone in the US will either have had the vaccination or been exposed to the disease.
Yeah, it seems fairly likely, not only in the US, because Delta is so highly transmissible. And we haven't even, you know, it's the summer at the moment, and we haven't got to the period where respiratory virus season, as we call it, when you'd expect transmission to be picking up again. So there's going to be a very different immunological landscape by this time next year. Looking out on the longer term, I think there will come a point at which COVID will become something that people like me are concerned about, and we continue to track in the same way that we continue to track other diseases like influenza, tuberculosis, and so on and so forth, but which most people don't pay as much attention to. But that's, and I, you know, we are so much closer to that point than we were, but we're not actually there yet. People, I mean, I think that we have to look back at where we've come, and how far we've come and how great it is, while at the same time recognizing that for the unvaccinated communities in particular, and there's a lot of people in the global South who are not vaccinated, we have to recognize that from a global point of view, we are still absolutely in the thick of this.
Thanks to our wonderful guests and to you for listening to Cambridge Forum's discussion on what we have learned from the first wave of the pandemic. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, the City of Cambridge, and you. So please step up and donate via our website, www.cambridgeforum.org. Take care.